And for me, my role in that is centered around the built environment, but also how our profession can show up for a larger society. And so I think that was the largest kind of mental shift, that what I'm doing is important.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. We appreciate you listening. And once finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. If you'd like to learn more about Designed and see all the other great content that Architectural Record has to offer, please visit architecturalrecord.com for more information. Enjoy the show and have a wonderful day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Designed by Architectural Record. I'm your host, Aaron Prinz. As always, I just want to say thank you to everyone out there for listening to the podcast, sharing it with your friends. It really means a lot. If you want to help us out, the easiest thing you can do to help share the podcast, get it out to more people so everyone has availability to this content, is go onto the iTunes review section, give us a rating, and it really helps. Of course, be sure to follow us on Instagram at designed.podcast. There you have all of the great episodes we have coming up and announcements we make. It's all in one spot. And of course, be sure to check out architecturalrecord.com. This week's episode, Pascal Sablon returns, second episode. I'm so excited. We talked to her about a year and a half ago at the University of Texas at Austin, and she doesn't disappoint this time either. It's a really great episode. She's one of my favorite people to talk to because she is such a personality that it's just, I love it. It's enjoyable. It's a really great conversation. So a lot to unpack in this conversation. We go over a lot of the events of 2020 and, you know, NOMA and how they're, what they're doing to really try to enhance the profession. So it's a really great episode. So I don't want to spoil it too much, but sit back, relax, enjoy. Here we go with Pascal Sablon. So what do I call you now? Do I call you Pascal? Do I call you Madam Vice President? What do you prefer? What's your title that we should go by? Because you are now the Northeast Regional Vice President of NOMA, National Organization for Minority Architects. What do you prefer?
Pascal sounds good to me. Okay. Because those titles are constantly changing. And as of last month, I was voted president-elect. And so I'll be the fifth woman president ever of the National Organization of Minority Architects. Dang. Super proud about that as well. So my presidency will be 2023-2024. And next year I become, you know, first vice president for Jason Pugh out in Chicago. So excited to step into a new role and to keep pushing forward.
Well, take us through a little bit. I'm not super familiar with NOMA, so can you just take us through what it is, what all you do for the profession, and kind of take our audience through what it is?
Sure. NOMA, again, is the National Organization of Minority Architects. Next year will be our 50th year of fighting for justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion in the profession. So we're not new to the game. It's always been the struggle. We advocate for both our members in terms of opportunities, but also dismantling the injustices that are embedded in the profession and in the built environment. We have a series of programs that really tries to support the pipeline of exposing students or young kids to architecture, supporting their application process in two schools. While they're in schools, have NOMA chapters where we build a community of students there. And then upon graduation, again, helping with employment, helping with mentorship, and then, you know, really career development and trajectory support. It's one of our best components of being a member is our national conference, which changed my life in so many ways. The 2014 conference in Philadelphia was the first time somebody said yes to me publicly speaking, right? And so I talk about that moment where, you know, it was NOMA that saw my aspiration and my potential and gave me a podium to try, right? And the reception from it was catalytic, say the least, and it got, you know, back to my employers that I can, somebody in the audience knew somebody at the principal level of my firm and called and said, oh my gosh, Pascal is a phenomenal speaker. You guys should definitely, you know, leverage that more. And so that really led to more opportunities for me. So, you know, for me, NOMA is the beginning of Pascal, an architect advocate, and Pascal, the volunteer architect, where I'm getting to know and understand what are the issues that are plaguing our profession and our society, and who are the characters who are oppressing and helping push forward for positive change, understanding the policies behind some of the things that we're fighting, and then really a community of people who are pushing to dismantle all of it, you know, tireless leaders and volunteers who put so much time and energy towards working towards it and just being strategic and being influential in trying to make those changes. So NOMA is an inclusive environment that's really fighting to just make the profession equitable. We've been doing it for a really long time. Our membership has grown substantially, I think even doubled under the presidency of Kim Dowdell. And we've made huge strides, and I'm really excited. And this year we had our virtual conference, which I was worried about because I know what, you know, conference in person does for me. And it was equally amazing, powerful, incredible lectures, seminars, panel discussions. I mean, it was phenomenal. So really proud to be part of this organization, and even more humbled to be elected into leadership position there.
Well, you talk about leadership on the national scale, right? But you've been a regional vice president, as I mentioned earlier. But what does NOMA look like grassroots within a community on the smaller local scale?
Well, it's interesting because I was, I started with NYCOBA, which is the New York chapter of NOMA. And when I started NYCOBA, I started as a secretary role, which was fun. And in that role, that's when I really started to understand the dynamics of the profession and the networking possibilities and opportunities that are within it. And then so through that time, I became elevated into president role at NYCOBA. And so on a local level, from my experience, it really was about creating consistent programming, right? That every month the members had something to look forward to that they could get into. Also about having community engagement, i.e. asking in January, the members, what do you want to see? What are the programs you need? What are the things you need to support you? That would be really important in terms of establishing our calendar for the year and making sure that we were creating enough variety in those programs and initiatives that we were really supporting the full pipeline of who we are. And then at that local level, it also gave us power and leverage to engage our local regulatory systems and organizations and have commitments and dedication with like MTA, DDC, you know, just the different agencies to create, again, a conduit and conversations between our members and the city to find out, like, how can we create more opportunities for those members? And then lastly, from a local level, creating and building a community. As my role as a Northeast Regional Vice President, I oversee 7 chapters, 7 phenomenal chapters that I get to meet and talk to.
Which one do you like the best?
No, can't do that. I can tell you which one has the best name.
Hands I just down, like to put people in like awkward situations when there's multiple things, but go ahead.
Well, I have 9 siblings. So I understand that it's not necessarily who you like the best, but like each person has a unique component that just makes them just amazing. And so I could tell you some phenomenal things about each of my siblings and why, you know, I love them. And it would be the same would be true for the local chapters. But the best name is Be More NOMA, which is Baltimore's chapter of NOMA. But Be More, done. I mean, you guys get that all, you know, I'm not even going to try to fight that one. But under the title of Northeast Vice President, I meet with the presidents twice a month and speak and talk to them about, like, how's it going? How's COVID impacting, you know, you and the membership? How's your environment there? I mean, we're in a collective community here, but let's really think about how we can help you get the support you need on that local level and you know, really engage one another. And, you know, we're planning a virtual all Northeast events. And just, again, I love it that we're just building communities and just kind of trying to maintain our bond and support our membership through this really difficult time.
Well, talk about difficult times. I don't think 2020, I think it's been, there's a lot of things that have happened this year. We can talk COVID, we could talk race relations, we could talk a lot of things. So how has 2020 kind of impacted the work you're doing? And has it changed kind of the goal or the mission, or how has that kind of evolved?
I'm going to be honest. You know, COVID for me was a very deadly disease from the very beginning, or for virus from the very beginning. You know, it took someone close to me who was not much older than me, who, you know, was really healthy. I mean, super healthy within like the first month. I was attending my first, you know, Zoom funeral for this man. And so I was never messing around with this. It was never about, oh, I can't get a haircut or I can't get my nails done. It was never that serious because I knew that COVID was more serious. And that actually humbled me in a lot of ways because I felt like with everything that was going on, I didn't have the right to post about what I was doing in terms of advocacy, or it wasn't as important when in the scheme of people just fighting for survival. And then I watched the lynching of George Floyd, and I cried so much, and because I felt helpless watching and knowing the inevitable ending of it, but then also hearing him cry, this grown man cry for his mother, you know, as a mom of a little Black boy. Ooh, that was so crushing. And I felt like everyone needed to do their part in dismantling injustice. And for me, my role in that is centered around the built environment, but also how our profession can show up for a larger society. And so I think that was the largest kind of mental shift, that what I'm doing is important. And it's part of this very complex racism, oppression, that's weaved into all aspects of life. And so if I want to get rid of it, if I don't want my son to be murdered by law enforcement and call for me one day, I need to do my part in continuing to dismantle it. But I had to restructure, I had to re-strategize how I was doing it. So previously, I would be invited to do a Say It Loud, and then I would have the exhibition, there'd be a call for content, we'd have the space allocated, and it was like, okay, we need to get 10 people, we need to get 20 people, whatever it is to fill the space, and then after everything's done, take photographs, and then upload pictures of the exhibition online. And that was kind of my sequence. But then realizing that, you know, public speaking couldn't happen right now, and physical exhibitions couldn't happen right now, I actually started converting my past exhibitions into virtual ones. So I created these thumbnails of the headshot and projects of everyone featured in the exhibitions under each type. And then now when you go on my website, you can actually do a virtual exploration of all my past 16 Say It Loud exhibitions, which is pretty dope. And when you click on it, it takes you to the Great Diverse Designers Library. So the other part of my Dismantling Injustice initiative that I launched on Juneteenth this year was Say It Loud Now. So typically in the terms of trying to make sure that I represent, I always waited for a community to invite me in, right? It wasn't like, hey, I'm going to show up Pennsylvania, y'all need to say it loud. It was more like Pennsylvania said, hey, Pascal, we're ready to say it loud. How can you support the process? And so this time I said, okay, looking at my map of the country, the state that I've been able to engage, there's a clear path area in the country where I was never invited. But there's still great, you know, women and BIPOC designers who deserve elevation. So in Say It Loud Now, it was, I don't care where you are in the world, you know, if you're a woman or BIPOC designer who's impacted, you know, the built environment, please submit. And the goal was to submit 250 new profiles, because I had originally 250 at the time. And I wanted to not just be the US, I wanted it to be global. So I wanted 10 submissions from each inhabitable continent as well. And we got close. We got to 172 new submissions. So the library now has 422 women and BIPOC designers featured. No paywall, like you just go on the site and you're able to explore and engage and to see their work. And they come with headshots, come with project imagery, their bio, what state they're located, what firms they work for, what inspired them, their proudest achievement, and video testimonials of them speaking about their experience. And I was able to interview or get a video from Robert P. Madison, who was the first African-American licensed architect in all of Ohio. And, you know, watching him talk was amazing, and learning about his family and legacy of architects, the Madisons. I also learned about the Whitleys, also in Ohio, which I never knew before also. And so this has become this historian process that's given me global reach. And really, I'm so hyped and excited about where we are. And that has led to more opportunities and kind of pushing that forward. So I say all this to say that I'm still doing the same and kind of similar in terms of elevating, documenting and elevating women and BIPOC designers, but I'm just doing it in a kind of modified fashion. And for those communities who are still reaching out and asking me to do a Say It Loud, we're starting virtual. We're doing the virtual call for action, call for content. we're creating the library, the virtual exhibition now for it. Those people are being uploaded into our libraries now. And then as we keep going, we just keep filling it out. And when it becomes safe again, we'll already have all of the content to then have the physical exhibition. So doing the same, but just in a different way and being able to build that information sooner in that capacity. And then I would say the last part is with the narrative and the conversations that have been centered around justice, that also has made me reflect on my role as an architect about how I'm helping dismantle that injustice through my design work, through my, you know, my 9-to-5, 9-to-6 work in my projects. Who are my clients? What are the community engagement techniques have I been utilizing? And really emphasizing and pushing that even further in the work that I do, as well as leveraging my position as AIA New York Board of Directors to help be part of the team that crafted the AIA New York statement about criminal justice, and asking our members to step away from designing, building, and constructing jails, prisons, and places of detention. And the reason that that's important, I mean, there's lots of reasons why that's important, but some of the high level kind of key components that I wanted everybody to understand is, you know, we started with 200, maybe 300,000 beds. In a very short amount of time, we're now at 900,000 beds. And a lot of these private prisons have a mandatory 80 to 100% occupancy rate. And so every time we create a structure or build a new structure, we are literally creating that force that's pulling those bodies out of those communities, out of their homes, away from their families, into these spaces where they're able to do labor for, you know, 15 cents to the dollar. And so just understanding that there's a larger dynamic that's in play here, and understanding that there's other architectural typologies that can take care of what we're trying to do in terms of the work that Dina Van Buren is leading and spearheading with restorative justice work. Brian Lee is also, you know, pushing and advocating for that. And just understanding that the importance of in getting to know the issues there, and then utilizing my positions and power to help create policy. And, you know, it really takes a community to see the issue and recognize it, and then try to make our contributions to dismantling it.
Well, I want to step back here because I think there's a lot of things I want to jump off here on. But my next question that I had written down, and you, I think you partially answered it, but I want to just go a little deeper into it if I can. I feel like architects, they have this sort of notion that, like, we can solve any problem in the world through architecture. And I feel like that's something that someone told them their freshman year of architecture school, and then they really ran with it. But
it's true.
Yeah, but I think you're actually hitting on a point. So when it comes to, let's say, racial injustice, as like a greater social context, really, how can architecture influence these sort of, you know, injustices and stuff that we're seeing in society?
No, I got you. I think part of it is architecture has a great power of communication. And we are very sensitive to our built environment, right? And, you know, from the sensitivities of walking up a pair of steps that are not perfectly like the same dimensions, you will trip, right? Your body innately understands and absorbs the information that the environment's giving you. But if your environment is giving you negative representation or oppressive vibes, you feel it, right? You walk into a space and you are not welcome. You know it, right? You look up in the highest point of your city and town, and it's a person who fought vehemently for your enslavement. You feel it, right? And so that's why I think architecture is not just, yes, we have a separate kind of different lens in which we look at it. But I do think architecture and the built environment impacts everyone, whether they're even cognizant of it or not. But to your question, we as architects and designers have this incredible skill set. We are problem solvers. We are leaders. We are oral and verbal communicators. We graphically know how to communicate. We know how to synthesize complex information and get it to the bone of it and break it down to even pull out more information that we leverage in our design process. So one huge thing that I've really been pushing for and advocating this year has been stop waiting for justice to manifest into the built environment before we think us as a profession can step into the conversation. We can literally be leveraging our skill set and our analytics and those components to help with society, with fighting for justice. Whitney M. Young, right? He gave the keynote at the AIA conference, 1968. And he said, you guys are great. And he's an activist. He was like around the times with MLK and, you know, just world leader, just pushing for advocacy. And he came and he noted and he said, wow, you guys are great at giving yourselves medals and pats on the back, but you are completely irrelevant when it comes to the fight for justice, civil rights and justice. And he was right. And in that moment, there was 12 individuals who were sitting in the audience who was inspired by what he said. And those 12 individuals went on to find NOMA, right? But I say all this to say that we keep saying that, oh, it's not really us yet. And it's like, no, it's already us. We can already participate. We can already protest, and we can protest in many ways. And then when we look at design as protest, which is an initiative that Brian Lee has done in New Orleans, but has really taken off globally and nationally, has been about how do we show up for society, where you'll ask society to come in, the community to come in, and say, what are the issues that are plaguing this community? What's keeping you up at night? And then just be in a room full of architects and we just problem solve, right? And the answer and the solution might not be a built environment, traditional architectural solution. It just might not be about critical thinking. It just us being in the room and having that conversation starts to make us relevant, right? And starts to make us be a resource to society, which is important and powerful. Then we can be leveraged and understand that we are relevant to helping solve society's problems, whether it's architectural or not.
Do you think, and this goes back to, you know, clicking on someone's website and their diverse firm is a bunch of white people. And I think what 2020 should have taught a lot of people, I think I've realized it, is that you cannot understand someone's experience from the outside or from really, it's even hard just having them tell you what their experience is. I think people's personal experiences and perceptions that they've built into their life is just something that's kind of innate and lived through, if that makes sense. So if you're having, and we'll just use this, it's a generic example, but a bunch of white people design something not for a bunch of white people, can that actually represent the true experience of what is needed in society?
Okay, I'll give an example. I went to AIAS grassroots conference last year, and I sat on a panel with some design justice leaders. And one of them was a professor, her name is Phoebe, and she talked about how she had a design studio where she had her students design a project for a Native American community. And for their midterms, they actually went to the reservation to present their projects. And the students presented and showed it off, and they were so excited. And then they asked the community there, like, what did you guys think? And they were like, do you want like the truth or do you want? And they're like, yeah, the truth. I'm like, oh yeah, we hated all of it. And they're like, wait, what? And they said, well, you know, you guys drew and designed things that were very orthogonal, harsh corners. And that's really not our architectural typology. Actually, it looks very restrictive and confining and oppressive. You guys really didn't investigate our culture. You didn't leverage our architectural language. You really didn't think about our day in life and what programs we need to support our culture and our heritage and how we, and our rituals, right? And so these kids in this moment got this huge lesson, which was your intention could have been the most pure, right? But if you don't actually engage the community you're designing for, you failed. So, you know, in that moment, it was humbling for a lot of them to understand that it's not a 5-minute Google search. It's not even a 3-hour Google search. If you're designing something for someone, you need to talk to them about it. And that's true for advocacy work, and that's true for design work. And so to your point, there are architecture firms like Concordia out in New Orleans who have something called a community fellow, where for each of their projects, there's a paid position where somebody from that community that's going to be impacted by their structure comes to all of their design meetings. Their role is to be the voice of that community and say, you know, this is working or this is not working. And also be a conduit between the design team and the community in both directions. And so for me, that's where you start setting up this successful infrastructure for design where, you know, it cannot be a monolithic group of people. And even if it's for a Black community and it's an entire Black design team, if none of us are from that community, same problem, right? And that's what we're trying to say. Not that because you're a different gender or a different race, you can't design for something. It's just that you will lack the awareness and cultural sensitivity and just understanding of what that society and that group needs. And so it's not just a matter of, oh, we look alike, so we all feel the same. A lot of the advocacy work that I do, there's a lot of people of color who don't agree with me, right? And so, and that's great. Not that it's great. I mean, not great, but I'm just saying that it echoes that there's no monolithic group of anybody. There's no monolithic group of white men. There's no monolithic group of black women. It's just, we're all different. And so what we need to do is build capacity to understand, engage, and embrace those differences and use them and leverage them in our design process.
I want to switch gears a little bit.
Sure.
You're quite the influencer, I would say. You know what I mean? So, I mean, you're in Forbes. Do you get any bigger than Forbes? I mean, so.
I don't know. I don't know, but I was very
well, I mean, Architectural Record's right pretty away. Great. So let's not, you know. But my question is, Pascal, as the influencer, your media exposure, kind of what does that do for your career in terms of activism in, you know, your professional life with a 9-to-5? And does that ever get in the way of what you're trying to accomplish to some extent?
No, it does not get in the way. It actually always helps, which is why I'm always like down to do the articles and do the podcast, because the more people hear about what I'm working on, then the more I can get people to submit and more people to help elevate the issues with me and help elevate these amazing people and the work that they've done. It also helps, I don't know, solidify per se, but it helps reinforce that the information, that the work that I'm doing is important, because not everyone actually sees it the same way either. And, you know, I started Beyond the Built, and, you know, we've done a lot between, you know, the Say Aloud exhibitions, the Say It With Media, and we're going to talk about that, by the way, Say It With Media commitment. Between all those components, we've done a lot, but I'm saying the words we like it's a group, and it's just me. And so having Forbes recognize me as a phenomenal woman blew my mind, because it really, it's a lot of the support that I need. There's a lot of my day, a lot of my time in terms of the advocacy realm where I'm just trying to convince people that this is important. You know, there's a lot of statements of solidarity that came out this summer. And when I approach for them to make actual substantial commitments to that work, it's a whole different vibe. It's a whole different energy. And when I reach out to women in BIPOC designers and say, you should submit and elevate yourself, there's a whole lot of convincing that they're worthy of that elevation and praise. And so, you know, the press is always welcomed. It's also always important to just kind of elevate people as much as I can. And so hopefully elevating me then also helps me, the opportunity for me to elevate the programming and initiatives that I have, get those moving forward. And honestly, some of those articles have created opportunities for me to kind of achieve the next steps in what I'm trying to do. So for instance, I'm trying to publish a book to be used in academia called The Great Diverse Designers Book, where we're showcasing the best of the best, right? Where the website is the database, but this book would synthesize and do some analytics about our work so that people can actually learn from our design process and learn from our ethos and use that in their studying and schooling and teaching and professional practice as well. And that was literally an opportunity that came after a publisher read my Forbes article. And so, you know, I find that media has huge power in terms of connecting people. And so trying to leverage that as much as possible to push the work forward.
Well, there's also, how do you just avoid burnout? You know, I just got done with architecture school, and that was like, now that I'm in like the 9-to-5, I'm like, this is really nice. I just get off and I go home. And then there's times where I'm like, I'm not going to edit this podcast this week. It's just not going to happen. I don't know. So, I mean, it's fun in the beginning, and then, you know, life gets in the way. I know you have a small child. I mean, how do you like manage life with, you know, all this extra stuff without just wanting to sit back and watch some TV once in a while?
That I don't do that. So I guess part of it is the mission is so authentic and intrinsic into my passion that it's not necessarily so much more work per se, right? It's something that I innately want to do and crave to do to push forward. I'm actually not worried about burnout. I'm actually worried about overexposure, where people are tired of hearing me talk or tired of hearing me advocate for the things and kind of step away, because then that will, again, to the point, take away power from the work that I'm doing. So that's actually more of my concern. So what I try to do when I have these opportunities to engage, to say, hey, I could talk about lots of stuff, right? Like, I don't have to talk about Just Say It Loud. I could talk about many, many things, so that when people hear me, it's not like, oh, it's Pascal, she's talking about Say It Loud again. It's like, oh, she's talking about, oh, she's talking about this MOU with publications. Oh, wow, she's talking about the children's book that she's writing. Oh, wow, she's talking about this, you know, reference book that she's writing. Like, it just kind of helps kind of diversify what we can talk about. So that has been really fun. But also in 2020, I learned to be way more patient with myself. This like expectation that I need to respond to emails within 24 hours, like, out the window. This expectation that I have to complete everything by this self-imposed deadline, out the window. And then also making room for my family, that they can't just see me sit in front of a computer all the time, right? That I need to step away from the computer and spend time with the little ones, spend time with my husband, spend time with my grandmother. Just, and you know, my guilty pleasure is just like laying down and watching Hallmark. Man, Hallmark movies is like the thing for me. But I just say all that to say that, yes, I definitely do take some time to rest and to lay down and to chill. And when I get to it, I get to it. And if your email had too short of a turnaround for me to get you that information, then I'm sorry I lost that, you know, I missed that opportunity to connect with you for that event or for that opportunity. It's just, you know, I need more lead time. I just need it.
I think that's a layer of legitimacy. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, oh, I'm so busy that I can't get to you in 24 hours. Like I said, I think it adds like a layer of legitimacy to your...
No, I think what I do need to start doing though is building a bigger team, and so that it's not all on me, so that people can be responded to more quickly. But like this understanding that 9 to 6 is I'm at my office, you know, designing and working. And so at nights and on weekends is when I'm able to really kind of catch up on my emails and make sure that I'm on top of things. And you know, I'm leveraging technology to help give me that organization or help me scope that organization to be on top of my calendar and be mindful of deadlines that are coming up and, you know, following up with people. I'm trying, but I definitely know that I'm losing and missing out on opportunities because of just my pace isn't faster, but I can only do so much.
The first podcast we did and much of this podcast has been talked about your activism and everything like that, mm-hmm. but you're also an architect. So, I mean, Pascal as the designer, Pascal as the architect, what's that like?
I'm super proud of the projects that I'm working on at S9 Architecture, where I'm a senior associate. And in 2020, in that self-reflection of me, my role as an architect, I was really happy to see it measuring up really against the work that I do during my 9 to 6. There's projects like Bronx Point, which is a 542 affordable housing building in the Bronx with the first ever brick and mortar hip hop museum, community facilities, retail on a public plaza, Upland Connection, short public walkway next to the Mill Pond Park, where it's really a project for the community that embeds the culture of the community and access to all, which has been like really amazing to see. And to be in those boardrooms and to hear the client go, okay, well, how is this project helping the community? Like, well, let's talk about it, right? That, you know, that it wasn't me changing minds, but just riffing and collaborating with just people who are just trying to make the world better for everyone, which is phenomenal. And in that experience, I also had the great honor and pleasure of working on the Cleveland Headquarters Foundation in Ohio. And, you know, that really stemmed from my advocacy work. They wanted an advocate architect to design their structure to work on their building because, you know, they're an advocacy organization in a lot of ways. And so being able to engage the Huff residents and the community there and have all those components and have the built environment again show up for them in a unique way has been phenomenal. And to see, like, you know, the community embracing the project was dope. But I'm not gonna lie, I also got hate mail intruding on their architectural space, that I should stay in my lane. So I think there's injustice embedded everywhere, honestly. But there was enough of effort and passion behind the client and the team and the community to help kind of push through those letters that were coming to my desk and keep doing the great work. And I cannot tell you how proud we are of the project. And it finally started getting released to the press so I could talk about it more. And, you know, you can see it on the client's websites. And, you know, they're really dope projects. I'm just super happy to be part of the project teams that were helping make those projects come to fruition.
So you've launched a lot of things. You've launched, yeah, I mean, we've talked about Noma. I mean, you didn't launch that, but you're a large part of it. But then you also launched Say It Loud. Now you have Say It With Media. Can you just take us through what is that, what you're doing, what's your goal, and what can we expect from it?
Sure. So Say It With Media really was a response to all the work that we had been doing with Say It Loud and all the content we had been gathering, right? And it was like, it can't just be about me gathering all this content. Now, how do I help elevate it and throw it out so that more people can see it? And so Say It With Me, Say It With Media is basically having media, digital, print, and broadcast commit to auditing how many women and people of color they feature in their publication, committing to increasing that percentage by 5% annually until a minimum of 15% is reached. Commitment to calling us great. And what I mean by that is when you Google the word great architects, Google Banner comes up with 50 names. One is a woman, Zaha Hadid. Zero are African-American. And nine are minorities. And so when I went to Google headquarters and said, hey, why is this happening? They said, well, Pascal, there's just not enough content out there that actually lists you all as great. Hence the Great Diverse Designers Library and the nomenclature for that. But asking these media publications to use the same vernacular that they speak about our white male counterparts that they do when they write about women and they write about BIPOC designers and not necessarily put those adjectives in front of it, right? And then also leveraging your resources and content for pulling historical content. A lot of the Say It Loud work that I'm doing actually captures contemporary, currently practicing individuals, but we've been here doing incredible work. So a lot of these publications have these research teams, access to archives that can help pull more historical content forward and make it available for us. And then lastly, commit to like using their platform to elevate those issues that are plaguing our profession and how it's being leveraged to hurt and not necessarily heal. And so that's the Say It With Media commitment. There's literally a webpage on my website under the Dismantling Injustice. I think it's action item number one, actually. And you just fill it in and you fill out that commitment and you get going. And so I've been negotiating and talking to many different publications, some you know, some you don't. And one of their largest concerns is just making this commitment and not finding the content. And I said, don't you worry, that I got, right? And that's why it's really important that the library stays free and stays accessible to everyone because I want students to use it. I want media to use it. And it's been great. I've had media publications reach out to me and with hyperlinks to some of the profiles that they looked at and was like, really wanted to connect with this person, this person, this person. And I just say, all right, great. Here's their email. Go be great. And seeing, you know, results come up like where you see articles about those people or about their work. Has been super dope as well. And I, you know, it's really powerful to see that it's starting to expand and blow up so that you're starting to see us not just talking about diversity issues, but you're also starting to see our work more featured and have us submit more white papers and such. And so I'm hoping that I can get important media publications to take on that commitment because it's very much in line with those statements of solidarity that was released. And it's actually saying we need to help be held accountable to it. to be keeping track of those numbers because honestly the other statement that they say is like, oh, we never kind of kept track of it. I was like, yeah, so how do you know how well you're doing, like, right? And how do you know you're actually going to be able to make change if you're not being held accountable to that? And the commitment allows it to go beyond that individual, but you know the organization is also being mindful and maintaining that commitment regardless of who's in leadership position.
I had trouble with this when I started the podcast because my goal was to go like one male, one female, one male, one female. And like it ran out real fast when I'm trying to get principals or founders of firms. And then someone wrote like a review on iTunes. It was like there's all a bunch of white people, blah, 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 something like this. But I say, like, kind of what you're saying, like, it's really hard because I look at the numbers of each podcast and everything, and as great as it all sounds, like, I think there is some sort of bias within the profession that I've noticed that if it is a woman, their numbers are maybe 80% of the downloads that someone, you know what I mean? Like a male counterpart might get. And like, I don't know. I think it's just an interesting aspect that there is an expectation to do that, but it's hard when you're trying to reach like a certain, because they're just, I don't know. I'm backing myself into a corner here.
Well,
think of what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah. And here's why I want to challenge you here. I think when you start representing a diverse audience or diverse people, you start to pull a different kind of audience, right? And so your audience is reflective of the content that you're pulling out. And so even though it might be difficult and it might have a notch of difference in percentages of who's downloaded and so on and so forth, that's not necessarily your only metrics of success, I hope, right? But also that it hits your mantra, hits your ethos, hits your mission statement about elevating design voices. And, you know, first saying it's okay that this podcast, when it's women, I know it's going to be a differential of percentage points. That's fine, but I'm still being able to give that woman the platform and a position to talk about great design. And that's part of why I wanted to go and connect with media, because, you know, we could talk about how great we are all the time, but on the cover of the magazines, if it's always white men, then we're not going to get those projects. We're not going to elevate to those positions because it's dominated that way. And people push and focus on media so much, not because it's like fun to have your face in print, but because that's equals to business development, right? Then developers and clients see you and like, oh, this is an industry leader. Let's hire them for our multi-million dollar project. And so how can we expect the profession to become just and equitable if we don't fight for that justice, right? If we don't make that happen. And so for you, I would say is, you know, I would define your metrics of success for both you and your leaders. And it's not always equating to the number of downloads, although that is one of your priority metrics, right? But two, the more content you put out there that has diverse faces, that has more women, then you become relevant to women and diverse audiences who will then tune in, right? And I think that's part of it, right? And that's why I want to recognize and identify who are the media publications who care, right? Who are the ones that want to receive pictures of our latest completed projects? Who are the ones that want to receive, you know, our white papers that talk about our expertise in a particular typology or a particular space or technique? Because not everybody wants this content. You know, there's a media publication out there that has been relentlessly erasing Black people from their podcasts, from their panels, from their print magazines. Architect Magazine did a panel in 2018 during conference. And they had five individuals, and one of them was Justin Garrett Moore, which is part of the PDC commission here in New York. He was sitting center stage, and it was a great panel. It was great. And then when they recorded it and put it out online, he was completely edited out of the video. His existence was no longer on stage. His answers to the questions were no longer part of the conversation. And the only time you saw him was a shadow of his profile when they zoomed into one of the other speakers. And so he reached out immediately and said, hey, y'all erased me from the entire show. What happened? Like, why? Crickets, never heard back. Then 2020 hit, things started getting viral, and they put out an article called The Erasure of Justin Garrett Moore. And in that article, they talk about it was a lapse of judgment. Now, you know the kind of editing you do for an audio.
Intentional lapse of judgment. It's not like, oh, you know, whatever. It's that's something pretty intentional.
That's right. And it takes a lot of skill to do that, right? And so understanding that, they put out that article. And so it's like, wow, they erased you and then made you feel silly that it was like, it was just like this button we just accidentally pressed and you fell off the face of the earth. But then again, it happened in May of this year where there was I take another panel with four individuals, three women and one Black man, Stephen Gray. You have the photograph of them sitting at the table talking. And then when it went to publication, it was only three women talking.
That is, and I know it's bad to say, but it's kind of, I don't want to say hilarious is a way, but like the fact that that's someone's mindset is in a way there's an absurdity to it that is kind of unbelievable, if that makes sense. Like that it's someone's, that they're that intentional about it. It says something.
Well, that's, I guess that's my point, is that there's way more intention in the erasure that's happening than we even give credit to or even understand. The erasure is happening. And so there are publications, like I was saying, who welcome and want our content, who want to elevate us, and there's others that don't. And so for us, we're always kind of just mindful of who we are and who's talking to us. So now on the website, the article has him back, but if you have the May 2020 issue, he's not there.
Because, you know, you've been in meetings. That's a discussion amongst not one person, but like a group of people. And they all came to a consensus.
That is right.
Who brings that up?
That is correct.
But think about the person that's like going into that meeting and be like, do you ever say something? You're like, nope. Hey, you shouldn't say this. Do you know what I mean? That someone had, first of all, the guts to say it. And then people are like, oh, yeah, that seems good.
But that's my point. I don't think it's even a conversation that somebody brought up. I think it's part of the policy that it's an option, right? That I think that they have their team are able to do that flagrantly and just assume that we won't notice and or won't have enough of an audience for people to notice. And so, you know, for me, I'm saying, well, I'm an AIA member and my membership goes towards getting that that magazine publication. And that's twice now that I know of that they've done this. So now AIA, with your multi-million-dollar contract with them, what are we doing? What are we doing? And so, again, media publications and elevation and erasure. That's why I have to fight so hard in elevating us, because there is an equally powerful force that's erasing us at the same time. So to you and to your podcast and this, you know, new chapter that you are embarking on here, and very proud to be a part of it. You know, when this gets released, this then gets distributed to my network, right? And so then they're like, wow, okay, let me tune in next time. But if they keep tuning in and it's back to back, you know, the same monograph, they're like, oh, Pascal was an anomaly, not the norm, right? And so you want to build a diverse community. And so to do that, you need to have diverse representation. So maybe you don't have as many downloads, but you have the demographics of your downloads change. And that's another metric of success that can show what you're doing is really important.
We went over last time we did our kind of our standard, you know, greatest moment, biggest setback sort of thing. And since this is your second time on the podcast, we have to revamp, do our new lightning round questions here. So if you had the ability to pick any typology, any type of project, no budget, no constraints, just design something, what would that project be?
It's funny because my experience when I first graduated was that I had projects with unlimited budgets.
Oh, rough life. You just live such.
So I was trying to debate in my head, should I answer like, oh, these past projects that I've done were like amazing. And it was like unlimited budget, the world's best thing. No, I would probably say, a restorative justice space. Cause I want to start developing or be part of the force. And be part of the components that's pushing for us dismantling spaces of oppression and thinking about architecture that heals. So it would definitely be restorative justice and putting as much support in that typology as possible.
If you could sit down and have a cup of coffee with any architect, it could be, you know, of a past generation, a current generation, who would it be and why?
So I don't drink coffee, so we're going to have hot chocolate.
Okay.
I would say J. Max Bond Jr. He was a very influential architect in New York. His firm is called Davis Brody Bond, if you're familiar. And when he passed, I went to his memorial at the Center for Architecture, and that's where I was introduced to NOMA and the community of diverse professions that I had never seen before. And he changed my world, and I only knew of him after he passed away. So I would really love to talk to him more and understand about his work, his process, his journey, and understand a little bit and have the opportunity to say thank you, because literally this person that I never met, I talk about all the time because his existence means so much to me and to our profession.
Last question. What's next for Pascal? What's next for NOMA? What's next for, you know, Say Aloud? Pick one, pick them all. I don't know. What's next?
What's next for Pascal is breakfast. No, I'm kidding. What's next for Pascal is, you know, trying to publish these books, which I think is important. What's next for Say It Loud? We have 6 planned Say It Loud exhibitions, virtual and then into physical, but toward the end of this year and early next year. So really pushing for more content there. Super excited. I saw this media image post that talked about Harvey Gantt out of North Carolina. And he was like the first Black architect to attend a school. And then I think his wife was the first Black woman. And then he became like the mayor or governor of that state. It was insane. Like, he was just a phenomenal person.
Being on a roll.
And I wanted to learn more about him. And they're like, oh, he's still practicing. I was like, what? We need to do a Say It Loud North Carolina right now. And so I'm so happy that we're actually doing one now to capture his story and stories like that. And then what's next for NOMA? Man, we are in line for a treat. We have Jason Pugh, who's becoming the president in January. For the next 2 years, we'll be really following his footsteps and his leadership and how he is envisioning to transform our profession and our membership and create as many opportunities of justice as possible. So when it comes to NOMA, we are in great hands with Jason Pugh.
Well, Pascal Sablon, this is always a great conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. And thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
Enjoy, everybody.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. If you enjoyed this episode, we would appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to the podcast, give us a rating, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.